everyone. This is the Sports Gig Podcast, your home for news in the sports media world. Back and better than ever after a brief layoff. I'm Dr. Chris Bacon from Middle Tennessee State University. In this episode, America's oldest publication is sold to a Hong Kong investment firm. Stephen A. is going to be on another ESPN show. And Tom Rinaldi is jumping ship at the worldwide leader. Today's special guest, Ed O'Devin, author of the book Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg, a collection of interviews with a legendary columnist. And in our job segment, a USL team needs a video production manager, a radio broadcasting internship opportunity in Wisconsin, and who wants to be a director of fun? Awesome job title. A great show's line up and ready to go, so let's get started.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, nom, 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 nom. It's bacon!
Here's your Bacon's Bits for the week. The Sporting News. Remember that magazine? Front Office Sports says it's being sold to a Hong Kong investment firm. Once known as America's oldest publication, founded in 1886, it stopped print production in 2012 and went completely online. No word yet on its future. Now, Disney dumped a ton of news last week and lost in the shuffle of Star Wars and other movies planned by the media giant. The company announced Stephen A. Smith is getting a new TV show. The plan is an early 2021 launch on ESPN+. And finally, Tom Rinaldi, the talented ESPN reporter who loves getting us to feel the feels with his stories, he's headed to Fox Sports. That's according to the New York Post. Rinaldi's been with ESPN since 2002. No word yet on his role or a start date at Fox. Our guest this episode is Ed O'Devin. He's the author of the book Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg, a collection of interviews with the legendary columnist. Well, Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Modern technology is quite neat. I mean, I'm in Tokyo, you're in Tennessee, and it's like we're on the same block.
It's one of those things that we've talked about. Zoom is one of those things that has opened up the whole world for all of us. And not that it's a silver lining with what's happened, the terrible things that have happened with the pandemic. It's forced us to do other things. And, you know, this is something that's probably not going to go away. And this podcast hopefully is not going to go away either, but it opens the door. We could talk to people, interesting people from around the world, not just people in our backyard. Yeah, you're in Japan. So, and you wrote this book, and I know who Jerry Eisenberg is. Anyone who's associated with sports media knows who Jerry Eisenberg is, but a lot of my younger listeners may not necessarily know that though. So for those who may be hearing that name for the first time, who's Jerry Eisenberg?
Jerry Eisenberg is a 90-year-old sports columnist who is still writing columns. And also he wrote his first novel this year, which came out a couple weeks after his 90th birthday in September. Jerry is semi-retired, and I use that phrase kind of loosely. He is from the Newark Star-Ledger in Newark, New Jersey, you know, very close to New York City. And he's lived in the outskirts of Las Vegas, Henderson, since 2007 or 2008 with his wife. And, he has continued his career covering the big boxing fights. He has covered every Super Bowl. One of two columnists who have ever done that. The other is Jerry Green of the Detroit News. And Jerry is... Jerry, I believe, is 91, so he's got he's just a little older. Now, this year, before the pandemic changed everything, Jerry Eisenberg did not attend the Super Bowl, but he covered it from a sports book in Las Vegas and wrote stories, you know, leading up to it all week long and afterward, and he predicted the final score and the winner correctly, the Chiefs.
Wow. So he's 90 years old. He's not... And he still has enough knowledge. Obviously, he's probably forgotten more than we'll ever know about sports. But to be able to accurately predict the final score of a Super Bowl, I think Vegas is the right place for him then, right?
Yeah, he's got boxing there. He's got access to, some of the big fights, warmer weather. he has trouble walking now. So part of the reason he did not go to the Super Bowl this year was just getting from the media bus to the stadium, you know, through the crowds, through up and down the logistically, it's difficult now. But even last year at age 89, he was covering the Kentucky Derby in person, the Belmont Stakes, the Preakness. He has covered these big events for well more than half a century. I'm talking about the Super Bowl, the World Series, you know, going back to the 60s, covering the Olympics, college football, you know, Grambling University was on his radar light years before a lot of other people knew about the school or knew about the significance of Eddie Robinson as, you know, a positive role model for African-American players and a guy who found the right players to go there and then molded them into players who can make the NFL. I mean, Grambling was a remarkable pipeline of football talent for decades. Doug Williams went there, just for example. So Jerry has Jerry's career is really the last 60, 70 years. Going back to 1951, he started out at the New York Star-Ledger while in college. So if you think of the changes in society and sports since 1951, we're talking about when Harry Truman was still president. Wow. So his career is all that. And then, you know, his upbringing, you know, through the Great Depression and World War II. So his experience is so different than, like, you know, someone who's 30 years old writing a column about the NFL. He has a much broader perspective, knowledge, you know, level of insights that make his work very historically significant. And also just, he also writes based on what he knew from before or what he wrote about previously. Like he can reference a column about, you know, the Green Bay Packers from 1967, and he was there. So that's what's unique about his work.
Now, if I read correctly, you grew up in New Jersey, right? And you have been able to follow him for your whole life. What was it like trying to put a book like this together on somebody you've obviously grown up reading?
To me, it was remarkably interesting and enjoyable researching his career and his influences, people he knew, people who knew him. Yeah, I was born in New York City and grew up in New Jersey. And I moved to Arizona the summer between my freshman and sophomore years. And in the early 90s, I graduated high school in 92. So the early 90s, I want some of my sports media habits as a teenager shifted to basically reading the Arizona newspapers mostly because that was what was there, you know, at the newsstand. And every now and then, you know, my uncle would mail me the copy of the Star-Ledger or, you know, a couple of years I didn't travel back east, but when I did, I want to pick up the New York Daily News, New York Post. I wanted a copy of the Star-Ledger to see what Eisenberg had written. And through the internet age, I've really been able to follow him a lot more closely because the columns were always posted online.
I can only imagine what that was like for you because we have a lot of influences on our own. You're a working journalist, you've been a journalist, and being able to talk to people who you have grown up reading and idolizing maybe in a way, mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't imagine. It's different than talking probably to current athletes that you have to cover on a day-to-day basis, probably.
I think Jerry realized that there was admiration in it, about his work when I spoke to him. And I think that kind of was noticed in some of the questions, but also it wasn't an immediate, like I didn't call him one day and all of a sudden we started working on a book. I had emailed him about just doing a few interviews and it took a few months because he was a busy guy. You know, he was still, you know, like most of the year he's got the Triple Crown races. He covers some of the big boxing events. He's writing remembrances on prominent sports people when they pass away. So he's in his 80s, he's retiring, you know, let him have his free time, right? Right. He's done enough. So it took a while to set it up, but I had actually emailed him years prior asking him just some general questions. And the fact that he wrote back to me kind of maybe thought, okay, maybe this guy is approachable.
Yeah, because not everybody's like that.
That's true. There's one guy, I think it's Pete Croato, is how you pronounce his last name. He wrote a book recently about the NBA, and Jeff Perlman had him on his podcast this past week. And Pete talked about how he reached out to the NBA like 5 or 6 times to try to get David Stern for an interview about the evolution of the NBA into a business giant. And every step of the way, he got rejected. David Stern just said, I'm not interested. So you can compare those two guys. Eisenberg agreed. David Stern did not.
Wow. Wow. Now, you talk about, all the things that Jerry has seen in his career. And, when he first started, Stanley Woodward was the legendary sports editor at the New York Herald Tribune. And one story that really stood out in my mind that you talked about in the book was when he got into Woodward's doghouse after spring training. And this is when he was, early on in his career. And talk a little bit about that experience and that story and how that kind of propelled him into what he ended up becoming.
Stanley Woodward was a very influential sports editor who, many heavyweights of the industry would refer to as the greatest sports editor of all time or one of the greatest, depending on your view. He had worked at the Newark Star Ledger on multiple occasions. And he also had been at the New York Herald Tribune, which was a newspaper that folded in the 1960s. But it was, it was basically competing with the New York Times for the audience. And it was very literary. The people that wrote for it were all great writers. That was the reputation. He was drafted into the military in the Korean War. So he left the States, was in Korea for a couple of years, came back to the United States and was working for some smaller newspapers, like a weekly and then a very low pay newspapers. And Stanley brought him into the Herald Tribune as a full-time writer, showcase writer, covering pro baseball, like in the 50s, and covering a lot of the prominent events around New York City. Jerry was assigned to cover the Giants at spring training. And he went from New York to Arizona, and they trained in the Phoenix area. And he thought, he was just the slickest guy in the world, writing all this flowery prose and describing where the Giants are staying in their hotel and describing the desert and the location of the mythical stories about the Lost Dutchman's gold mine, which, in the history of the West, there's thoughts about how with the conflicts between the Spanish explorers and, the rulers and the Indians, that, yeah, there's a bunch of buried gold, somewhere in the desert there, east of Phoenix. And this found its way into one of Jerry's stories. And the tone of his coverage just really pissed off Stanley Woodward. And Stanley wanted coverage about the competition for who's going to be the starting shortstop, who's going to be batting first, what is the pitching rotation. That was the kind of meat and potatoes coverage that Stanley wanted. He wanted to inform the readers. He wanted Jerry to inform the readers. And that was what he wanted from him going out to Arizona for a month to cover spring training. And in those days, telephone calls and telegrams were, pretty much how you got in touch with people. And word got to Jerry one day, probably after he, called in his story, And Woodward said, I want you back in New York City tomorrow. You got to come back. And so he had to fly back to New York. And he cursed at him, he wanted to know who were competing for the infield spots. He said, I don't care about the Lost Dutchman's gold mine and, the background outside the window of their hotel. I don't care about the view of the mountains and the cactus. I want to know who are in contention for the starting positions. And he pulled him off the beat during spring training before the baseball season. He wasn't plagiarizing somebody, or, you know, he wasn't arrested for, you know, robbing a bank. His editor didn't like what he was writing. And Jerry idolized Stanley Woodward, and he was in his doghouse. And, you know, it really got at him. Stanley didn't speak to him for a few months. He was assigned to work on the copy desk, you know, and just edit stories 2-3 months. And, you know, like, his career was in the dumps. He was depressed. He only had, like, contact with a few guys on the news desk at night. And he felt like crap because of it. So I think Stanley's point got across. And then, you know, they used to have like a chalkboard, or just like a place where the schedules were posted. And one day Jerry walked by the desk in the Herald Tribune news department, sports department. And he saw his name there, and it said desk, desk, desk. And then it had an assignment for golf. And out of the blue, he was asked to go cover a charity event that the New York Herald Tribune also sponsored. And it wasn't, you know, like the U.S. Masters or, you know, some prolific event like the U.S. Women's Open that just ended. It was something called the Anderson Memorial Golf Tournament, way out in the boondocks in Long Island, a place called Montauk, which, if in the geography of New York, Long Island is, you know, stretches out of the city and goes out into the ocean, you know, that island where Queens is. And it's the far northern tip of the island. And to get there from New Jersey, it's like a 3 hour trek by car. And so the opening day of the tournament, Jerry's up, he's up at like 3:34 in the morning, you know, like probably worried that he's going to get there late and, you know, he's going to get stuck in a car accident, you know, and then he'll blow his only chance maybe about getting out of the doghouse. He gets to the event, the country club way out in Montauk, you know, before the sun came up. The usher, like, in the press room is like, why the hell are you here? Like, what are you doing here this early in the morning? And also, why are you covering this event? Like, no one covers this. You know, we might do a press release. You know, it might be maybe two paragraphs. Now, Jerry was told, you have a very strict word count, you know, like the length of your story is going to be short. And once he got wind of a certain story, he just, like, said, the heck with it. I'm going to write what I want. And what he found out was, on the first day of that event, was there was a guy, a golfer in this event, who his face had gone through the dashboard of his car during a car accident. And he had a glass eye. And this guy, you know, was adjusting to life without normal vision, you know, like the use of both eyes. And this is like the first real life test, something he had to do, like, beyond looking straight ahead and walking, like, in a room. So Jerry actually, like, followed this guy throughout the entire 18 holes of the event. Jerry's story was focused on this guy and, you know, the interaction between them when he was walking with him during the tournament. This is a very unique story and, you know, a great scoop. And he went back and wrote a story and wrote, like, twice as long as what he was asked. And once it was typed, it was 2 pages long, I'm guessing single spaced. And he sent it in. We're not talking about, you know, through email or through, you know, through sending it through Twitter or something like that. This was sent, you know, either by a telegram or, you know, he handed it in at the desk. And he said his reaction after that was, the hell with it. You know, I wrote what I want. This is the story. If they cut it in half, fine. But this is what story had to be. So the next day he goes, walks to the local convenience store, the local market, and buys the paper, looks at it, and the entire story's there. And, you know, it kind of confirmed to him that, he did something right, and that Stanley Woodward maybe is not going to hate his coverage for the rest of his life. So within the next couple of days after that, Jerry's back in the office, and he looks at his schedule again, and it said college basketball, college basketball, college basketball. So he started covering pro, you know, events again, and he was back on the beat with what Stanley wanted him to write. And this was probably 1957, 1956, I should say, at that time. It might have been 58 after the Giants had just moved to they might have just moved to, I think it was the year before they moved to California. So probably he was 57. So he was about, at that time, he was 27 years old, or just turning, he would have been 26 in spring training, and he turned 27 in September. So, you know, early in his career, he's getting pushed around, and he had to learn what, you have to please your boss to a certain level, right? To be able to be on the beat.
Yeah. And you fast forward at the end of his career, I believe I read where Woodward's daughter had written him a letter about what her father had said about him, about some of the greats that he had worked with. And he mentioned Jerry. And going from that very beginning to where he was in Stanley's doghouse, basically, to where at the end of it, where he said he's one of the great ones, it's almost what may not have been if he wouldn't have taken that chance so long ago.
Stanley was very good about spotting talent and keeping tabs on the entire nation as far as sports writers go. He recruited Red Smith from the Philadelphia Bulletin to join the New York Herald Tribune. He had followed Jerry's career after he had left, after both of them had left the Star Ledger. And, you know, in those days, you go to a newsstand, you buy 5 or 10 newspapers, or you have people mail you clips. And this is how Stanley had followed Jerry. And you mentioned the letter that his daughter wrote about Jerry and her father's words. Now, when Woodward passed away in the 1960s, Jerry had visited him quite a bit up in Connecticut where he was living. And, you know, he would visit him at the hospital or visit him at home. And they were close until until he passed away. But those words of admiration, actually, Jerry got wind of that decades later when he was inducted into the National Sports Media Hall of Fame. That letter had been sent to him. And he actually mentioned that letter at his induction ceremony, induction speech.
Wow. That, talk about things coming full circle. And that just really struck me when I was reading the book. Another thing that struck me reading the book was the closeness that Jerry has and did have, 20, 30 years ago with some of the athletes he covered, including Muhammad Ali. There's some great stories about his closeness with Muhammad Ali. How was he able to form those types of bonds with athletes during that time period?
The fact that social media was not, expected of him, and it wasn't like a big part of his life, and he wasn't like trying to have hot takes like maybe Stephen A. Smith, that kind of style of confrontational or just trying to get hot clicks wasn't what he was doing. He was building relationships. He was promoting the cause of equality. And, he was against bigotry, very a prominent opponent of the fight for racial justice before a lot of writers and broadcasters, were doing that. But also he was a great listener, a great storyteller. He had empathy. He still does. And, this also helped him form good relationships. He didn't have an agenda other than telling good stories. And that really helped him to maintain and to keep friendships.
In this day and age, it's kind of hard. It's almost like there's a big barrier that we see nowadays with journalists and with athletes and in some cases, rightfully so, but it can be somewhat difficult if you are a writer or a journalist where you're trying to really dive deep into a story and all you get are we take it one game at a time, 120% type quotes and sound bites. Is there anything that you could, that you think people today can take from Jerry and apply it nowadays in trying to get really to the heart of stories and really get to know these people?
His career and the arc of his career, follows a time when the general sports columnist was really the heavyweight of the sports section. And, you know, there was real prestige in what he did. Guys like Jim Murray and Red Smith, we mentioned Red earlier, but he was like the star of this. He was the star of the sports department at the Star Ledger. In 2020, a lot of people that write columns are basically the beat writers of a certain league or a team. You're not having the heavyweight columnist do everything. So often the coverage is more analysis and stats or analytics driven, where it's overkill with numbers. And Jerry always valued stats, and you know, statistics are important to tell a story about how a team won or why a team is good, but he focused more on the personalities and the human drama within the stories. So kind of like the Shakespearean style of what is, you know, the human drama here. That played out more in his coverage, and it gave him more of a broader sense of what the story is. I think people can learn from that, and younger writers probably especially don't have to like be driven by metrics and all this, you know, all these stats. Sometimes it's overkill.
There's also something that stood out was the story about Junius Kellogg in 1965. And for those who don't know, Kellogg, he was a former college basketball player, played for the Harlem Globetrotters, and he was in an accident that ended up having a cervical spinal injury, and afterwards mm-hmm. became a huge supporter of wheelchair basketball. And Jerry, you know, wrote about that. And then what kind of, you know, and it ended up having a huge impact on the public and their perceptions of wheelchair basketball. You know, talk about that, and, you know, talk about how his power was able to really focus the world's attention on certain issues that may not have been covered just because we all worry about who's starting for second at second base for the Giants that year.
One thing that Jerry was excellent at, and he still is, in my opinion, is spotting a story that other people are not always writing about, and like an issue that might be light years ahead of the pack when it comes to promoting a cause or being progressive about an issue. I think part of the reason he focused on Junius Kellogg was he himself had been a soldier. You know, he had served in I believe it was the army in Korea. And, you know, he's seeing his buddies get injured or die. He's seeing the effects of war on the physicality of a person. So he's well aware of Junius Kellogg, how his life changed by this spinal cord injury, how he was confined to a wheelchair. And a lot of the wheelchair basketball players after World War II were former veterans of the military. That was a way for them to get some form of exercise and have camaraderie and have you know, a sense of accomplishment, not just sitting in the room in a chair all their life. These touring wheelchair basketball teams and events were often staged in the 50s and 60s, even before like the New York Knicks played, or before a college basketball doubleheader. They would have these events, and it was a way of raising money, raising awareness, but it wasn't covered that extensively. And, you know, Jerry went to one of the bigger events in New York and interviewed Kellogg, you know, urge people to send money in to help support this team and the wheelchair basketball players and, you know, their medical bills. And his column was syndicated throughout the United States at that time. And, you know, proceeds were coming in not just from New York, but, you know, other states, other cities, probably as far away as Alaska.
Wow.
So it was the power of a column and, you know, trying to get people to do something positive. And, but it was done in a very smart way through the prism of a game. You know, there were details of the team and of how good of a coach he was. Kellogg was a great wheelchair basketball coach years after he was a good player at New York University.
The second part of the book talks about other people who are reflecting on him. and you had some really good names in part two of the book. And I'm just curious, just from your own standpoint, what are some of the things in part two from some of the people that really stood out to you, and what other people thought of Jerry and what his impact was on the industry?
I tried to get a cross section of people that are probably, you know, even as young as in their 30s, to people that are close in age to Jerry. Greg Bishop is a Sports Illustrated reporter, covers a lot of football, boxing, a lot of big stories these days. I think he's about 35 now, so he's probably the youngest guy I quoted extensively in one of the quote sections there. And Dave Anderson, who was at the New York Times, and his career was essentially the same timeline as Jerry. He passed away a year or two ago at age 89. So I tried to basically have the current generation who are post-college and people that are roughly Jerry's age, which there aren't many of them employed, you know, writing. But Dave Anderson was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And one thing that Dave said that was very revealing to me was, you know, not everybody should have a column. Just because you have an opinion doesn't mean, you know, your blog has value. Your writing has to have facts. It has to be based on, you know, knowledge of a subject. Yeah, anybody can have a blog to have a hobby or to have, you know, something to do in their spare time. But that doesn't make you a journalist. A journalist is reporting the news. A journalist understands the facts, knows the subject, has an authoritative spin on what happened or what is the reason something happened. And so Dave saw all those values in Jerry's writing. And I thought that was important to make a distinction between blogs and a newspaper columnist, because a lot of the columnist jobs have disappeared.
Right. Because everybody has a platform now. I mean, you think of Twitter, you think of blogs, you think of, you know, it's easy to have a website. You put, you know, social media pages together, and, you know, people make, you know, social media influencers, people make very good livings now just writing about opinions without really backing it up with very many facts. But it's more impactful if you have more, it's more fact-based opinions rather than, I think because I this is just from what I see from a 25 or 30 year old point of view, who's never really been in that atmosphere before. He has a unique perspective on things.
Those are all good points. And also, I think what Dave was getting at, Dave Anderson, he wasn't telling people not to write blogs and don't aspire to be columnists. He was telling them there's a distinction between just having a blog and being a columnist. And I think that's an important point. Now,
right.
Other people that I spoke to that probably some of your listeners would know about, Jeremy Schapp is a ESPN host through E60 and through his own sports, various programs that he did with his late father. And he hosted a lot of the segments like the Sports Century going back to 1999, when ESPN spent a lot of time and money trying to like rank the entire 20th century teams, sports, the greatest games. And Jerry was a talking head on a lot of these segments. And Jeremy Schapp, you know, really admired Jerry for his historic knowledge, his feistiness in making an argument. Like, to him, Babe Ruth had to be ranked higher than Michael Jordan. To Jerry, Jerry knew about Babe Ruth when Babe Ruth was still alive, knew about his career. You know, he probably saw Babe in some exhibition games back in the late 30s. When Babe retired, Jerry would have been four years old, but he had direct knowledge of people who had covered, you know, Babe Ruth, Red Smith, for example. And everything isn't like, you know, right in front of you that the greatest thing that ever happened was, you know, happened yesterday. Jerry had a much broader knowledge of the 20th century than, you know, people who were born, 60 years later. So that also was an important aspect of why trying to put his career in perspective and give people a bit of a primer on what makes his career unique. Why is he an important voice in the year 2020? How he views the sports world, those kind of things. Another thing that I think was important was Wallace Matthews, who wrote for several New York newspapers, New York Post, New York Times, some of the smaller papers, even New York Sun, which folded recently, you know, a couple of years ago, and is an online publication that most people don't know about. But Wallace also wrote for that publication, and he always admired Jerry for being a voice of moral courage. And, you know, standing up for Muhammad Ali, he spoke about how when he was growing up, he knew about Jerry because his father would bring all the papers back home, you know, to their house. And he admired how Jerry, at a time when the Vietnam War was extremely controversial for a lot of people, or, you know, there was two sides to the issue. There was no middle of the road. You're either for the war or you're against it. You don't see it as like, you don't see it as, you know, maybe it's okay. Maybe it's not a bad idea to be over there. A lot of people had no interest in supporting two things about Muhammad Ali: changing his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, and supporting his right to, you know, not serve in the military during the war. And Jerry, through his columns and through his broadcast platforms, he supported those views every time. It took a progressive view on life and on society through sports. When one of Jerry's counterparts, Dick Young, was you know, an arch conservative, and at every possible opportunity bashed Ali for having those views.
Gosh, that's just a unique background and just a unique story. And hearing some of that backstory, because really all what people hear and see is what's in print right in front of them, you know, and this right. really kind of takes you behind the scenes, especially people who may have grown up in that era that read about it. Now you're getting to see, you know, a different angle to, you know, how he went about his business, but how other people did as well in regards to their reflections on him as well.
Jerry has remained a person that takes on controversial subjects throughout his life. I'll give you another example that is a lot more relevant probably to your students who are in their early 20s, maybe even teenagers, right? Right. You know, Jerry has been a vocal supporter of Colin Kaepernick to take a stand that he took, and also to play in the NFL again. You know, I mean, how many guys that are 89 or 90 years old that you know are criticizing Roger Goodell for his handling of the NFL, you know, the way he kind of danced around the issue for, you know, for a few years before issuing an apology that was sort of half-hearted, I would argue. But even before that apology was issued, Jerry wrote a column, you know, saying essentially that Roger Goodell's, you know, is light years behind the times in terms of issuing an apology.
I'm curious about this. When you showed Jerry this book, what was his initial reaction?
He thought it was really well researched. He's also sarcastic quite a bit. He's like, you know, you could have picked a more interesting guy to write about. He's like, but then he said, like, thank you for your interest. I think he was generally touched that somebody wanted to share his life with other people that might not have a chance to know about him. Like, his reading audience, I think, is more loyalists and diehards who have followed him for years. So the fact that I took the time to channel his knowledge and his career and introduce him to other readers, he just seemed generally humbled by the and honored. But he didn't particularly like single out a certain story that I wrote about. He just seemed more like delighted that someone actually took the time to do it.
So what's next for you? You're out in Japan right now. Do you have any other projects coming down the road, or you kind of focused on working in the present right now? What's next for you?
I'm kind of focused on trying to promote this book, which currently is in ebook format, and I'm exploring some ways to sort of affordably self-publish a print edition, paperback. So I'm trying to do as many podcasts and radio shows as I can. It's difficult to get airtime during a pandemic, and the fact that I'm in Japan rather than in the States, it's a little bit of a challenge, but it's kind of fun where I find a show that says, yeah, and we get the green light and we set it up. It's an adrenaline rush in a way. I started at the website Japan Forward in May. So it's a new company that was established in 2017. So I'm just trying to build up coverage of sports for this new website. And we don't have a big budget for, you know, a lot of people that are in sports. I'm the only full-time person right now in sports. And I'm trying to bring a few people on board next year to do part-time work and, you know, be correspondents and help me out. And it's also, we're trying to figure out how we're going to cover the Olympics, you know, and what actually is going to be the sports calendar next year. It's quite ambiguous right now, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and you talk about what's going to be the sports calendar next year. We could barely get through the week without understanding what's going to be on the schedule and what's not going to be on the schedule and cancellations. I can only imagine trying to handle trying to handle everything with the Olympics.
I mean, when I was at the Japan Times, I was sent to Beijing and London to cover the Olympics twice, and great experience, dream come true. I was so happy that I was able to do it. And when you're there, you're not awake 24 hours a day, but your mind is thinking about the Olympics and only the Olympics, essentially, for three straight weeks or the full 16 days and, you know, a couple of days before and a couple of days after. So to try to go from a daily newspaper to a new website and to try to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to present it, it's very interesting.
You're talking about the book being in an ebook format. Where can people, if they're interested in the book, where could they pick it up? Where could they read it online right now?
I would maybe post a link to edodevonreporting.com. And I have a press release on the site that lists all the different ebook shops. The most prominent of the sites that currently has the book, Barnes & Noble and Apple Books. Also, Google Play.
Okay. Good deal. Good deal. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of good momentum going with this book and a lot of a great input, a lot of great background, but also something that's very much things that people could use today and learn about, you know, a person who has seen it all and lived it all, especially for these last, you know, 5 to 6 decades or so. Well, Ed, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I know this is our time differences are a little bit different, but I appreciate you taking the time and doing all this. I appreciate you for taking the time to chat with us today.
It's not about the paycheck. It's about respect. It's about looking in the mirror and knowing that you've done something valuable with your day.
The new year is upon us. How about a new job? Miami FC needs a video production manager. This person will create content for fans in the stadium and also over digital platforms. You'll need a bachelor's degree and 3 years of experience in the sports video production field. Know Spanish and 3D animation? That'll help as well. To apply, go to teamworkonline.com. Hey, college students, need that big break in radio broadcasting? The Wisconsin Woodchucks of the Northwoods Collegiate Summer Baseball League needs a broadcasting intern for the 2021 season. This person will broadcast all home and away games for the team, 72 in all. That's a lot of good reps for a college student. To apply, go to woodchucks.com. Sticking with the Northwoods League, this one a full-time job. The Bismarck Larks is looking for a director of fun. Sign me up. This person handles all aspects of entertainment for the team on a year-round basis, including content creation, social media, game day entertainment, and much more. To apply, go to LarksBaseball.com. That's it for this episode of the Sports Gig Podcast. Special thanks to author Ed O'Devon for joining us. Be sure to check out the website at sportsgigpodcast.com or follow on Twitter at sports_gig. We'll see you next time.